Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Welcome back to the first week of, the second day of the first week of the brand new year. Tom Hartman here with you. My resolution for this year, actually, let me give you a little background on this. Some 25, 28 years ago, something like that, I don't know how long, it's long ago and far away, I was sitting with a fellow who, as I recall, his name was Nathan Gray, who was the founder of Oxfam USA in Boston. We were having breakfast, and he had started a bunch of organizations. And I said, how do you know what you're going to do next with your life? And he said, I have three criteria, from the least important to the most important, in ascending order of importance. The least important, but has to be there, got to make a living. Number two, middle importance, got to change the world for the better. And number one, the most important thing, I want to make sure that I'm having one heck of a lot of fun. And so those have been my resolutions every year ever since, and I have found it to be a great guiding principle. Can I make a living at it? Can I change the world in a positive way? And can I have a lot of fun doing it? And so that's my resolution for this year, and I sure am doing it. And I'm wondering what yours are. And or what you think maybe, you know, Tom DeLay should be or George Bush's should be or whatever. Feel free to let us know your thoughts on that. 866-440-8466, our telephone number. Also drop into our chat room if you'd like at TomHartman.com and say hi to some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. And just great stuff out there. Jack Abramoff about to roll over. There's some two dozen, more or less, members of Congress, apparently, who are sweating and sweating seriously right now. That Congress is going to come back today and say, hey, we're here. We'll see you later, and leave and then reconvene again next week. And I still don't understand exactly why they do that, but they're apparently going to do that today, probably to fulfill some, you know, you got to do it thing in the law or whatever. And but apparently not to raise the debt ceiling. But that will be coming. That will be coming because supply side economics is such a failure, which we will be getting into. In the meantime, in fact, we'll be getting into in this hour of the program. By the way, as we go a little later on in the program, in the second hour of our program, Van Jones, the founding director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, is going to be with us. Have we replaced incarceration? How do we replace incarceration with prevention in our local communities? And in the third hour of our program, we're going to have Nancy Anton on NewsHounds US. They watch Fox, so you don't have to. And get the latest spin. What's Fox up to right now? It really is nice having somebody out there who watches Fox for a living so that we don't have to. And then tells us what's going on over there. It's incredible. George W. Bush, again, strongly defending his domestic spying program this last weekend, saying that it's legal as well as vital to thwarting terrorist attacks. Vital. He said this is a limited program designed to prevent attacks on the United States of America, and I repeat, limited. I think most Americans understand the need to find out what the enemy's thinking. Yes, we do. George, we all do. We really do. George, in fact, I got to tell you, and any, you know, Republicans, conservatives, whatever you might call yourself, listening, we all agree. If bin Laden is calling somebody in the United States and saying, hey, you know, go bomb that building, if bin Laden's calling somebody in the United States to wish them happy birthday, I want our intelligence agency to know about it. Agencies, and so do you. We all want this. Of course we want to know what the enemy is thinking, particularly since, George, you haven't caught bin Laden yet, and we're going on 5 years of this nonsense. So the nonsense being George W. Bush's, he's going to find him dead or alive, right? But here's the problem. And this is one of the reasons why you have four senators out here, four United States senators, two Democrats and two Republicans, saying that when Congress comes back into session next week, they're going to start hearings on this. They're going to look into this. Here's the problem, and it's a big problem. There's this thing called the exclusionary principle, or the exclusionary rule, which goes back, there have been Supreme Court rulings about this, Miranda one of many, which say that if you are trying to prosecute somebody in a court of law, and hopefully somebody who's actually a terrorist will actually get prosecuted in a court of law. So far, we haven't seen that happen, at least in any meaningful way that I've been able to notice here in the United States. Have you noticed anybody being held accountable for 9/11? Yet, by our court system? Maybe it slipped by me. I know the families of the victims of Oklahoma City bombing, they were allowed to have some closure allowed. They got the benefit of some, to see the guy who did it get put in prison. And, for those of you who are death penalty advocates, to even, see Tim McVeigh croak. But the families of 9/11 haven't quite had that satisfaction. And we, the people, haven't necessarily had the safety that might come from the perpetrators of misdeeds being caught and prosecuted. Now, here's the problem. If you want to prosecute somebody in a court of law for a crime, and terrorism in the United States is a crime, you have to use evidence which can be used in a court of law for prosecution. And if that evidence was obtained illegally, you can't use it. Which raises the question, and I think this is a really important question, why does George Bush want to contaminate the evidence against the terrorists he says he is tracking in such a way that they will have an opportunity to avoid going to prison? Why would he want to do that? I mean, are we sliding into tinfoil hat territory here? I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are going, well, why hasn't he caught bin Laden? Could it be that it's because bin Laden's half-brother, Solomon bin Laden, bailed him out in his failed oil company and then died in a suspicious plane crash, small plane crash in Texas, when the Texas authorities started looking into it? Could it be that, you put your tinfoil hats on, all kinds of conspiracy theories about why Bush hasn't caught bin Laden. Bush himself, he's rather sanguine about it.
So I don't know where he is. I just don't spend that much time on him, to be honest with you.
Yeah, just don't know where he is. Don't spend that much time on him. But you have to ask the question, and I think it's a legitimate question. Why would he want to contaminate the evidence? Why not simply go to a FISA court and say, hey, it's an Al-Qaeda guy. Here, look it. And they'll say, cool. And then Bush can say, oh, by the way, we already wiretapped him 2 days ago. No problem. Up to 3 days, 3 days, 72 hours. You can do it without a warrant. So why would George W. Bush want to make it almost impossible to prosecute these guys? I mean, you've already got Jose Padilla petitioning the court to find out if information used against him was obtained by illegal wiretaps. You've already got the few people who have actually been prosecuted for some sort of terrorism. There's a bunch of people here in Oregon who apparently were involved in supporting terrorist organizations now saying, hey, wait a minute. We might need a new trial. Why would Bush want to sabotage this? Marvin in McKinney, Texas. We have about a minute to go here before we got to take a break, Marvin. You have a specific thought on this?
Yeah, I was just going to say that as far as contaminating the evidence and not being able to go to trial, mm-hmm. He doesn't try people.
He just kills him.
Not because there's some terrorists. He just locks them up.
Oh, he just locks them up and throws away the key. Yeah. And but how long is he going to be able to continue running concentration camps before somebody says, hey, enough already. You know, we don't have concentration camps in the United States. I mean, I just, you know, it's at a certain point. And thanks a lot, Marvin, for the call. It's at a certain point, I think we've got to say, no, you know, we need to do things by the law. That's what the United States is all about. That's the ideal that we're holding up to the world. The reason why 15,000 people marched, many of them to their death or imprisonment in Tiananmen Square in 1989, was because they wanted the rule of law. China, by the way, a big story. Falun Gong, the religious sect in China, again being persecuted, several of its members beaten, raped by Chinese police. Yeah, Walmart's allies, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman radio program. COINTELPRO, or sometimes referred to as COINTELPRO, depends on who you're talking to, but the anti-intelligence, the counterintelligence program that was put together by the FBI in 1956 under J. Edgar Hoover and ended in 1971, at least theoretically, was a program that started out saying, we're not going to go to judges and get warrants. We're just going to, you know, snoop on folks and infiltrate them, and, you know, we're just going to find out what's going on. And then they started acting like provocateurs in times and places. And I have to say, in the late 60s, I was involved with anti-war activity in Michigan, and we found out later that the FBI and the Michigan State Police had both infiltrated these things. They had the Michigan State Police, the Red Dog Squad, I believe it was called, and, you know, the papers came out, and there we were, and we discovered that the one guy who was always in the back yelling, you know, hey, let's go, you know, start a riot, actually was working for the FBI, as I recall. Might have been the State Police, one or the other. And some of my friends back there are still, I mean, you know, one of them, Mike, got his files, and it was like, you know, this thing was like 2.5 feet long, this stuff. Well, it's back. In the Southwest, paid informers infiltrate church services, Bible classes, and support networks of clergy and lay workers, giving sanctuary to refugees from El Salvador and Guatemala. In Alabama, elderly black people attempting for the first time to exercise their right to vote are interrogated by FBI agents and hauled before federal grand juries hundreds of miles from their homes. In New England, a former CIA case officer cites examples from his own past work to warn college students of efforts by undercover operatives to misdirect and discredit protests against South African and U.S. racism. In the San Francisco Bay Area, activists planning anti-nuclear civil disobedience learn that their meetings have been infiltrated by the U.S. Navy. In Detroit, Seattle, Philadelphia, Cambridge, Mass., Berkeley, California, Phoenix, Arizona, and Washington, D.C., churches and organizations opposing U.S. policies in Central America report obviously political break-ins in which important papers are stolen or damaged while money and valuables are left untouched. This by Brian Glick, an introduction to COINTELPRO, revisited. All of this now, recent, right? This is not the old stuff from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. This is stuff that's happened in the last couple of years. So it's back. Bush is back. And I guess the question, Dave, you have to ask yourself, Dave in Wilmington, Delaware, you have to ask yourself is, do you want Hillary Clinton to have that kind of power?
You're asking me that?
Yeah, I am.
No. I think the premise of all of your questions, Tom, are based on things that I just can't understand.
Okay.
And if we go back to, for instance, Bush doing something illegal, what did he do that's illegal with this phone tapping?
Well, let's just frame the question in a little more abstract fashion for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
If Hillary Clinton was president of the United States, and she was to say to you, Dave, that she had the absolute right to listen in on anybody she wanted to, and she did not have to go to the judicial branch of government, she being the executive branch of government, she did not have to go to the judicial branch of government like the Fourth Amendment requires and prove that there was some evidence of a crime before she listened in on your phone conversations or your wife's phone conversations with her doctor or her best friend or you know, you with your girlfriend or whatever. Would that bother you?
Well, I'll answer that question if you answer me one thing. Why are you asking the question? Is that what happened with Bush?
Well, that seems to be what George Bush has confessed to, yeah.
Seems to be. You see what's happening? I've just started listening to your show, Tom, and it sounds like you might be one of the left-wing wackos, but I will hold, you know, I'm going to listen more and make an educated decision.
Well, I appreciate that, Dave.
But why, and I consider myself kind of in the middle.
I'm pretty much quoting George Will on this, by the way, who is about as far from left-wing wacko as you can get.
He's
very concerned about this.
And he's, well, I'm not saying we shouldn't be concerned about it. But
here's what William Safire had to say. William Safire, the scion of the right, here's what he had to say about it this weekend, and we'll play
but
this.
The FBI was illegally tapping his phone at the time. And so they hear a White House speechwriter say, hey, you want a leak? And so they tapped my phone. And for 6 months, every home phone call I got was tapped. I didn't like that. And when it finally broke, it did me a lot of good at the time, frankly, because then I was on the right side. But it told me that how easy it was to just take somebody who was not really suspected of anything for any good reason and listen to every conversation in his home. You know, my wife talking to her doctor, everything. I have this thing about personal privacy.
So, you know, Dave.
But you see what's happening, Tom, is you're getting snippets and sound bites.
These are conservatives objecting to George Bush listening to people without a warrant.
Is that what he was talking about?
That's exactly what he was talking about. He was talking about George Bush. This was Sunday on Meet the Press.
George Bush tapped his phone?
No, actually, it was Richard Nixon. And he was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon at the time.
But you see what's happening? I'm talking about George Bush, not Richard Nixon. And you posed the question, why would George Bush want to taint the evidence for anybody we might capture? But
Dave, hang on just a second. Let's continue this conversation on the other side of the break. We got to take a break here. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. The True People's Radio.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
They sell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. The same time they sell us our war. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the wild.
And welcome back. 26 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. Paul Revere, who made his living as a silversmith, created a bowl, actually a whole series of them. There was a set of them that he made, 92 of them. And on the rims of the bowls, he inscribed, Paul Revere personally inscribed the words, to the memory of the glorious 92 members of the Honorable House of Representatives of the Massachusetts Bay, who undaunted by the insolent menaces of villains in power, from the strict regard to conscience and the liberties of their constituents, on the 30th of June, 1768, voted not to rescind. Okay. On the opposite side, these are called the Liberty Bulls. On the opposite side of one in particular, which happens to be the property of the John Marston's family in Massachusetts. I'm sorry, Northern Louisiana. It says, number 45, Wilkes and Liberty. This bowl was made specifically for Mr. John Wilkes. not John Wilkes Booth, but John Wilkes, who was one of the fighters in the War of Independence. And below his name is a picture of a torn piece of paper. And below that is the phrase, General Warrants. Now, I'm wondering, Dave, if you know why it says General Warrants under the torn paper under Mr. Wilkes's name.
I suspect this is going to have something to do with privacy.
Because Mr. Wilkes was arrested. He was one of the many people for whom Paul Revere made these bowls, who was arrested under a general warrant. A general warrant was where the king said that he had the right, regardless of a court, to arrest somebody simply because he said so.
And why are you bringing that up?
Because George W. Bush has asserted that he has the right to intercept telephone conversations or other information, or for that matter, to break into people's homes. He has the right to investigate in pretty much any way he wants, simply because he said so. And the founders of this country said, that's fine. We want to find bad guys. We want to prosecute criminals. However, we don't want absolute unchecked power in any one of the three branches of government. So anytime the executive branch is which has the prosecutorial function and has the police power, essentially, of the United States, the Supreme Court, the judiciary branch does not have police power, and the legislative branch does not have police power. Whenever somebody from the executive branch is going to exercise that police power, they must prove to the judiciary branch that there is some justification for it.
I disagree that he said that he has the right to do that, although I will admit that you, I'm sure, have read a lot more on this than I have. But my premise is that if George Washington, you referenced George Washington, George Bush, you referenced Nixon, mm-hmm. if George Bush did something illegal, he needs to pay the price for that. But what I hear on the left radios and the left articles is that he's done it.
Well, we can get into a whole separate discussion of what is right and left, but here's George Bush in his own words, talking about FISA.
Yeah.
Quick to detect and prevent. We use FISA still. You're referring to the FISA court in your question. Of course we use FISA. But FISA's is for long-term monitoring. What is needed in order to protect the American people is the ability to move quickly to detect. Now, having suggested this idea, I then obviously went to the question, is it legal to do so? I swore to uphold the laws. Do I have the legal authority to do this? And the answer is absolutely. As I mentioned in my remarks, the legal authority is derived from the Constitution, as well as the authorization of force by the United States Congress.
And now we have conservatives like George Will coming forward and saying, sorry, the Constitution says you don't have this right.
And I think all I'm
and this is the same argument that Richard Nixon made.
And I think all I'm saying is be more of a watchdog than an attack dog. If I was sitting with Mr. Bush, I would say, that's fine, I understand. All I need is the details of the law you're referencing that says it is legal for you to do what you did.
Right, and that was the question that was asked him, and he just said it's in the Constitution and it's in the law that authorized him to attack Iraq, and it's not.
And I think
he lied.
It's okay to ask that, but we're assuming he did it without. I mean, that makes
no. He's confessed that he did it.
No, we're assuming that.
As John Dean, the Republican John Dean, the former counsel to Richard Nixon, said in an op-ed piece that was published in Find Law 3 or 4 days ago. Richard Nixon. George W. Bush is now the first president in the history of the United States to have confessed to an impeachable offense.
But how do we know that it's an impeachable offense if we don't? Nobody has looked at any law that he's referencing. That it intimates that the White House does not have the legal acumen to look up this situation before he does it.
And the White House has been unable to produce a law. You just heard George Bush say it's in the Constitution,
right,
and the authorization for Iraq. I have read both.
Okay.
And there is nothing in either that says that we are setting aside the constitutional requirement that before the executive branch exercise police powers, they first demonstrate to the judicial branch that there is at least some probable cause that they need to exercise those police powers. And I don't think either one of us want this kind of power in anybody's hands. You,
right.
You probably would be more concerned about Hillary exercising it. I'm more concerned about George exercising it. Frankly, I'm concerned about Hillary exercising it just as well.
Okay. And that's interesting. I think I will try and find those to read. I have not read those.
Okay.
So.
Well, I encourage you to check it out. Dave, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah,
it's great
thanks,
to hear
Tom.
From you. Thank you. Bye. Charles in Carmel Valley, California. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind today, Charles?
I had a question for you. Which nickname do you like better for Bill O'Reilly? Bill the Shill O'Reilly or Bill Blacklist O'Reilly?
I'm a little fond of loofahs, but I don't know. I think that, you know, the whole thing of kind of marginalized people and picking on them, you know, I know Rush Limbaugh likes to do that. He has sheets for Robert Byrd and Dinge for, what's his name, the head of the Senate, Harry Reid. I think it's, frankly, it's sad. I would rather address people. You know, I don't call George Bush names. I'd rather address their behaviors than go after them like that.
Okay, well, you probably won't like this point either, because
okay.
I was thinking that, you know how they degraded the Democrats and the liberals by marginalizing them and speaking them with contempt, and those words were considered, bad things or marginalized them?
Yeah.
I think we should do the same thing back to them, and... You know, before anybody uses the word right wing, they should begin it with either dangerous right wing or corrupt right wing, and just keep using their method of attacking by using those over and over again.
Yeah, well, I know that there are people suggesting that, Charles, and I think it's more important to simply identify what they're suggesting and identify what we're suggesting. I mean, it's and let people make up their own mind. Let people understand, you know, what's happening in the United States. And that's by and large what I'm trying to do in this program. I really don't think that, frankly, I think what that'll do over the short term is further divide America. And this is, you know, we've had, by and large, 15 years of this, and it hasn't helped civil discourse in this country. It hasn't helped politics in this country. So I got to move along. Charles, thanks for the call. Jesse in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jesse, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I'm looking at the Center for Constitutional Rights run by, or the president, Michael Ratner. Have you spoken with him? Or?
Yeah, I know Michael.
You do? Okay.
He is, by the way, the brother of Ellen Ratner, who is with Talk Radio News Service, who is on this program quite frequently.
Oh, wonderful.
In the second hour of our program, every 20 minutes after, in the second hour of our program every day, we get a report from Washington, D.C. from Talk Radio News. And Ellen just had some eye surgery last week for a detached retina, but prior to that, she was on the air with us for the last 2 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we've had Michael on the program a number of times.
Wonderful, because Dave, who was just on, I was just dying here listening to him, because I'm looking at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Michael's quote is, "The warrantless wiretapping of citizens and residents of the United States is flatly illegal. It's a violation of criminal laws and an impeachable offense." So Dave's saying, "I haven't seen it." Well, all you have to do is, you know, look.
Well, that's one person's opinion. I mean, and the bottom line ultimately is, you know, just as with any criminal defendant or anybody accused of something, let's investigate it. And that's what the Senate is talking about doing. And when you've got, like, Senator Lindsey Graham, who led the impeachment of Bill Clinton, coming out and saying that he wants to investigate George W. Bush, Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, I believe, saying this, you know, I say, yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Jesse, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Charlie in Atlanta. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Well, Tom, I'm listening to your discussion today, and, you know, the thing that gets me about the Republicans like Dave is that they seem to feel that the United States Constitution is written in Egyptian hieroglyphics, for which you need a Rosetta Stone.
That's pretty straightforward stuff.
And it is very straightforward. I urge your listeners to read Article 2.
I was just going to say Article 2 of the Constitution, which lays out the executive branch's powers and the limits of their powers, including the oath that the president has to take. George Bush says he took an oath to protect the people of America. He didn't. He took an oath to protect the Constitution.
Well, that's correct. And the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees our rights against unreasonable search and seizure.
That's right. And the Third Amendment, which is a variation of that they can't quarter soldiers in our homes, which nobody is accusing them of, but that's really all what that's what King George was all about. And we fought that war. I'm sorry, it was called the Revolutionary War. Charlie, thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
suggest because he wasn't really elected. Just because that ballot count wasn't fair. Just because him and all his friends are millionaires.
Don't mean he don't care.
Don't mean he don't care.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. Bill in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program. Bill, you are live and on the air if you're there.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Bill.
My name is Bill from Bellingham.
Yep.
And you had asked earlier about the...
Why is Bush contaminating the evidence? Yeah, you got to turn down your radio and just listen to the phone. Why would George W. Bush be contaminating evidence in a criminal trial? Or is it that he is actually not, that he's actually getting FISA warrants for wiretapping terrorists, and the people that he's wiretapping that he doesn't want to go before the courts are Democrats?
Well, yeah, my thought on that was that one possibility was that he might be contaminating the evidence so he could then declare the court system, not capable of pursuing investigations successfully.
I don't think even John Roberts would back him up on that one. You know, I Roberts and Alito in particular, I think, you know, Alito has a long history of very non-conservative. I mean, the stuff that would make Barry Goldwater and Everett Dirksen and Dwight Eisenhower roll over in their graves, supporting government power against the individual. That's Sam Alito. But I think even on that, Sam Alito would not, and certainly John Roberts and some of the other conservatives, and Scalia and Thomas, I don't think that they would go along with it. Pardon?
Is that required? Is it required? Like if you
it would end up before the Supreme Court. If Bush tried to declare that the courts were invalid, it would end up before the Supreme Court. Yeah, absolutely.
But I wasn't going to say invalid. I was just saying ineffective, you know, to give him to that way score more leeway, to give him the ability to do more. I mean, look at the Patriot Act. You know, that has a lot of stuff that's kind of devastating to our rights, and yet there it is. You know?
Yeah, I know, and that's why it's being challenged, and that's why a lot of good conservatives like Ron Paul from Texas are challenging it very aggressively. Bill, you know, an interesting point. I suspect, frankly, I got to say, I suspect that Bush is not that stupid, and I don't think he's using these warrantless searches against terrorists. I don't think that he would be dumb enough to contaminate evidence. I'm curious who he is using warrantless searches against. If we look back at the last Republican president to do this, it was the opposite political party. Greg in Oskaloosa, is that Iowa, Greg?
Yes, Iowa.
Hey, Greg, what's on your mind?
Hi. The last couple callers have been castigating Dave the Republican, and I just wanted to call in and defend him a little bit.
I thought Dave was quite reasonable.
Yes, exactly. And I thought that if they were all like him, we probably wouldn't have a problem. He was just asking for evidence.
Yeah.
He just wanted to be very clear about what Bush had done.
Yeah.
That's
good,
all I wanted to say. Yeah.
Good on you, Greg, and I'm sure Dave appreciates it, too. Dennis in Decatur, Illinois. You're live and on the air.
Hey, Dave, Tom. Basically, I think Dave doesn't understand something here, that a policeman who gives you a citation for jaywalking or speeding must cite on that citation what code you are violating. That's all we're asking the president to cite.
Well, he actually has to do two things. Number one, he has to cite the code or the law. And number two,
right.
He has to sign it saying that either he saw the crime being committed or he has evidence that the crime was committed.
Correct. Now, my big point, and I think you had a caller just about two calls ahead of me, I think he's making a larger point here. There is this distrust of the judiciary that conservatives have. They were going against activist judges last year, remember?
Oh, yeah. That's been going on for 15, 20 years, yeah.
Yeah.
It's been going on since Earl Warren became Chief Justice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I drove through the South in 1964. That's all you saw was impeach Earl Warren.
That's right.
Why?
That's right.
Because he interpreted the law the way it should be.
Well, he interpreted the law the way you and I think it should be. I mean, it was very different than the way the law was being interpreted in 1913.
The check and balance against a police force or a police state is the judiciary.
Yeah.
A cop can say you're speeding, but a judge has to say, I weighed the evidence, yes, you are.
Well, and the judge has to say you go to jail.
Right.
And that's the big difference. And Dennis, you make an excellent point, and I appreciate it. Bob in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
Listen, Dave sounded like a very thoughtful guy, which is kind of scary. This is a thoughtful conservative, but he does not have any information. He hasn't read the Constitution. He hasn't read the law. That's what I love about your show, Tom, because you give primary sources.
I try to. I mean, the bottom line is, there you go.
You know, is it
consistent with the law? Go ahead.
I looked at the law. I've read the Constitution. I read things for myself, I think. And the right listens to people like Limbaugh, and that's where they get all their information in the whole world.
Yeah, and it's a sad thing, Bob. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's good point. And these guys, they just, if they can't be, attacking somebody, they're not happy. If George Bush can't be trying to scare people, it seems like he's not happy. I mean, he's not very optimistic, shall we say. Eugene in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eugene.
Hi. I got on the call because I wanted you to get your point and outlook about Ralph Nader. We heard about him. Only time we hear about him is just around the election time, and it appears as though it's used to derail votes. And then after the election, you don't hear about him. And it appears as though we won't hear about him or from him until the next election. And I'm going to
maybe the case.
I want to hear your opinion on that.
Okay. Well, Eugene, it's a sufficiently complex opinion that I can't just toss it out real quickly. But I appreciate your calling. The bottom line is, I will confess, in 2000 I voted for Ralph Nader, but I lived in Vermont, and I knew that it was going to go for Gore. The state was, the state's electoral votes were going to go for Gore, and had I lived in a swing state, I probably wouldn't have. But I felt, ultimately, very well, it was a learning experience for me, let's say. And we'll talk sometime about the difference between a two-party state like we have here in the United States and a multi-party state. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. In low-income communities and communities of color across the United States, people are raising a cry for freedom from the harassment and brutality of the expanding criminal justice system. So notes the front page of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. They go on, while it spends hundreds of millions of dollars to expand the prison system, the government is underfunding public education and social services. Van Jones is with us. This is our Bioneers segment for the day. Bioneers, the organization founded in 1990 and working to promote practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Van Jones, director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. Van, what's wrong with spending millions of dollars throwing evildoers in prison?
Well, first of all, the main evildoers are in the White House, and they're not going to go to prison anytime soon, from my point of view. But, the problem that we have is that if what we want in urban America, I live in Oakland, California, I'm raising a son here, if what we want in urban America are peaceful streets and safe communities, the strategy that we're pursuing right now is the stupidest strategy that one could ever imagine. We are defunding the community programs, the schools. The schools don't, not only do they not have art programs or athletic programs, we now have, one of the high schools here, 30 kids in the classroom, 6 books, no chalk. We are defunding everything that will keep kids out of trouble, and then we're throwing all this money at building prisons, and yet it's been demonstrated statistically every day that a young person spends, locked up in a juvenile hall or locked up in a youth prison, they are more likely to get in trouble when they get out. So what we're saying is, we want community safety, but what we don't want is a big incarceration industry that's profiteering off of building more prisons and making our communities actually less safe.
It seems that there's more money to be made in private prisons than in schools.
Well, that is the sad underside of the American economy, is that we now have, and most people don't know this, we now have a huge industry of private, for-profit prisons that are profiteering on incarceration. You say, well, what's wrong with that? You know, maybe you can privatize the prisons, maybe you can save some money, do it more efficiently, let the market step in. Well, the two things that happen when you do that, and they're happening now across the country, is you suddenly have people that have an economic interest and a financial interest in building more and more prisons. These people are now acting as lobbyists, paying money to campaigns, money to candidates, buying legislation that increases prison sentences, makes them longer, not to make things more safe, but to keep an active, growing population of people behind bodies they can make money off of. In other words, we're back to trafficking in human bodies.
This is mind-boggling, and I suspect that most Americans are not even marginally aware of the proportions of this.
Well,
I understand, for example, that Marriott, one of their major sources of revenue is the imprisonment of people.
Well, as a result of a very successful community campaign that a group called the Prison Moratorium Project ran, they finally were shamed into selling off their stocks.
They did. Marriott divested themselves of, was it Correction Corporation of America?
Exactly.
CCA.
Marriott was the major holder of this horrible company, Correctional Corporation of America. The other one, which some of your listeners may have heard of, is Wackenhut.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these are traded on the U.S. Stock Exchange. Basically, we've turned the Dow Jones into this kind of, you know, high-tech slave auction where we're trafficking in bodies, and most people do not know that the criminal justice system they learned about in school, where you have, you know, a defense attorney and a prosecutor and a jury and that whole thing, and you're trying to find guilt or innocence, that thing has been completely colonized now by big corporations that are turning our criminal justice system into a source of money-making. And there's only one way they can make money: build more prisons, have more people locked up, and have them serve longer sentences at the taxpayers' expense.
I was going to say, I heard a statistic, and I think it was in one of the years, one of the recent recession years, like 2001, when there might not have been quite as much construction, but that the major or the most profitable or the most active, I forget the exact parsing of the words, construction industry in the United States was the industry of building private prisons. This is a billion-dollar industry.
Well, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. Just in California alone, which is where we're doing our work, it's a $6.7 billion industry.
Just in one state.
In one state. So when you think about California, now in California, the privatization hasn't been the problem. The main problem in California, ironically, is that the prison guard union has taken on that role of trying to get more prisons built so they can have more union members. So you can see profiteering on, you know, in any number of ways. But the big problem that you have, even in a state like California, people think California, they're so liberal, blah, blah, blah. Look at the numbers. Follow the money. We spend more money in California, $6.7 billion a year on prisons, than we spend on all of our four-year colleges and universities combined. So you think about UCLA, you think about UC Berkeley, you think about all these great public schools in California. We spend more money on prisons than colleges, even in California.
Van Jones, founding director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, the website ellabakercenter.org. To what extent does this track back to the Rockefeller drug laws? Was that the beginning of all of this?
Well, there were two big waves that created the problem that we have now. In New York State, you have the Rockefeller drug laws, where they tried to get tough on drugs. Rather than treating the drug crimes that were going on as crimes of addiction and economic desperation, where you need to have some carrots, you need to have some sticks, you need to have some healing opportunities, like we're now doing, for instance, with meth, right, with methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
In some states, with methamphetamine, you're seeing a little bit more of a balanced approach. Of course, those are mostly white drug offenders.
Mm-hmm.
When it was African-American drug offenders, crack cocaine and other stuff, it was all sticks. Well, you had that wave, which was in the 80s, which toughened up the drug laws. Then you had, in the 90s, the whole three strikes and you're out idea,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, any kind of offense, you know, drug, property, violence, whatever, you would right. wind up with these very long sentences. Now, yeah,
these guys who got life in prison for stealing the candy bar.
Well, exactly. Pizzas, bicycles, bouncing checks. It sounds great when you're on the stump speech saying we're going to crack down, but when you look at the financial consequences and the human cost of putting somebody in prison for the rest of their lives, when, you know, for maybe when they were 17 years old, they got into 18 years old, they got into a fist fight, when they were 19 years old, they stole the car, then 20 years later, they bounce a check and they've got to go to prison for the rest of their lives, which we had in California, you know, not just one case, numerous cases like this. You realize that what sounds like great rhetoric can be horrible public policy, and we are struggling now to reverse that. That's why our campaign, Books Not Bars, and you know, you can go to booksnotbars.org, is focusing on trying to close the youth prisons in California and across the country first, because we feel like people will understand very quickly that spending $80,000 incarcerating a kid, when you could, you know, send two kids to Yale for that, makes very little sense. We want to start with closing and replacing youth prisons with smarter rehabilitation centers, smarter options, being smart on crime, and from there we want to move on to the adult prisons.
Yeah, it strikes me, you know, you go back and you read Ben Franklin's autobiography, and he talks about visiting London back in the 1670s. 1760s. And he was horrified by the poverty that he saw and people who lived on the dole, basically. And what had happened was the king had set up this system of enforced poverty, you know, giving people enough money that they could survive to prevent a revolution, and yet providing them with no opportunities whatsoever for social mobility. And it really seems that when Ronald Reagan shut down the free, you know, public education system in California, said no more free college, mm-hmm. the bootstraps, the opportunity to move into, you know, into the economic center of the United States, got shut off for a lot of people in this country. And we really need to be focusing on those kinds of things, on building a positive infrastructure rather than the negative one.
I think you're exactly right. And the thing about it is, when you invest dollars in those kind of solutions, you create taxpayers who can keep the economy going, as opposed to people who are constantly going to be a tax drain.
Yeah, absolutely, and so well said. People can find out more about this what was the Books Not?
Yeah, sure. Our campaign website, booksnotbars.org, booksnotbars.org. You can also go to ellabakercenter.org.
ellabakercenter.org. Yes. Van Jones, the founding director. This is our Bioneers segment. Bioneers.org also helps us put this together every week. Van, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for the great work you're doing. Keep it up, please, and keep spreading the good word.
Thank you very much. Books not bars. Schools not jail.
There you go. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Good morning, America. How are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, the city of New Orleans. Most of the people who live there are at least 500 miles away right now, tragically. The absolute, utter, mind-boggling, mind-numbing incompetence of FEMA, which had performed so brilliantly in 2004, the election year in Florida, when it was hit with Hurricane Charley. And FEMA was there with water, with people, with tents, with tarps, with food, with everything you could need. Just absolutely amazing. Welcome back to our program. Our quote for the day from John Adams, second president of the United States, first vice president of the United States. Power always thinks that it is doing God's service when it is violating all his laws. Indeed. From John Adams. COINTELPRO, 1956 to 1971, the program from J. Edgar Hoover. The growth of domestic intelligence starting in 1936 through 1976. It really began in the 30s when the government started spying on we the people. And the very first one with the FBI, the pre-war era, 36 through 45, looking for subversive activities. And this was about the time that the FBI began to say, we really don't want to be supervised by the Attorney General. And then from 46 to 63, you had FBI programs, the FBI joining with the military and through this whole thing. And then 64 to 76, let's get the commies. And then the Church Committee came along. And in 1975, looked into the abuse of domestic spying by the Nixon Nixon administration and previous administrations as well. Cy Hirsch, actually, on December 22nd, 1974, Seymour Hirsch published a piece in the New York Times laying out these operations, these covert programs, from assassinations of foreign leaders to infiltrations of domestic groups that just broke the dam open. 5 years before that, 5 years before that in 1970, had been Chris Pyle speaking. Oh, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, hi. I've actually got sort of three areas I can go to. I just want to make a quick comment on your insurance. As you know, Talk Radio News Service and Shalene Espinoza and I bought a piece of land in Mississippi to build a community center down there in DeLille and Past Christiane. Well, guess what? Everybody says, oh, you can't go suing the insurance companies because then they'll never insure. Well, they were refusing to insure the property now.
Really?
And we have not seen these refusals because most people have not started the rebuilding process. We have to buy a piece of land with one house standing on it, and they're refusing to insure the property, insurance companies, and are trying to send it to these high-risk, you know, people who get DWI, real loan shark insurance.
Sure.
So watch out what's going to happen there, because that people aren't going to be able to get insurance.
Well, I think part of the problem also is that the insurance industry is looking at global warming, and they're saying, you know, what happened last year is probably going to happen again next year in terms of weather, and you know, they're reassessing the risk. I mean, Swiss Re, which is a reinsurance company, they insure insurers. They were 15 years ago when I wrote Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, 10 years ago, 12 years ago. They were, you know, there was a whole big piece about how they were the first ones who were in the corporate world who were aggressively saying, we got to do something about global warming.
Well, you got it. Speaking of global warming, there's global messaging, and it's happening at the White House. The White House is starting their January assault with what they're calling dual messaging. One is that Iraq is going well, and if you trust the president, they'll be able to, he'll tell us when they can take over their own security. He's making a speech at the Pentagon tomorrow, and then he's going to meet with several former secretaries of defense at the White House on Thursday. This is part of his lead-up to the State of the Union, which, interestingly enough, is January 31st. But, of course, during the Democratic primary, they moved it up so it was the day after the Iowa caucus, if you recall, in 2004. Yeah. And their also message is a strong economy. And to that end, they're going to be hitting the road. The president is going to be going to the Chicago Board of Trade and then making a speech on the economy at the Hilton. Then he's sending all his supporting cast out, such as the Commerce Secretary. They're going to be sending somebody to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, this is their big dual sort of points that they're trying to make before the State of the Union address on the
31st. He's basically recently here in the last 24 hours or so, that one of the messages we've gotten out of the administration is that they're basically not going to be funding much more reconstruction. Isn't he now beginning to do what Jack Murtha suggested?
Well, yes, but reconstruction is a joke. It was only $18 billion for reconstruction. Oil output is about 300,000 barrels less than before the war, and electricity output is less than before the war. So So this reconstruction thing was a joke to begin with. Only $18 billion, and 20% of that has been taken for security.
Yeah. Ellen, we've missed you. I hope you're feeling better.
I am feeling better. Thank you.
Good, good. Thanks so much for being back with us. And sorry I missed that you were on the line there for the first few minutes.
Okay, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, we'll talk to you then. Ellen Arata with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
My bills are all due, and the baby's need shoes, but I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county will haul my belongings away. I'm busted.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. And Johnny Cash there, it's a song from the Depression, but also a song from what might be coming down the road. I'm going to get into this whole discussion of economics here and what's coming down the road, what the economic indicators are. We'll get into a little more detail on that tomorrow. I want to do the first hour, a good chunk of it, on that very topic. James Risen's book is out. This is absolutely extraordinary, the early reviews of this thing. Risen, this morning, was interviewed on the Today Show. Katie Couric. She says, I know you broke the story, as we mentioned, for the New York Times. Why do you think the people who talked about the secret program came forward and told you about it? And he says, well, I think this is the most classic whistleblower case I've ever seen. He says, in this case, I've been a reporter for about 25 years. This was the purest case of whistleblowers coming forward, people who truly believed there was something wrong going on in the government. And they were motivated, I believe, by the purest reasons. Now, this is fascinating. There's a piece in Mondo, Washington by James Ridgway. Actually, it's in the Village Voice. Mondo, Washington is the column. And in the Village Voice by James Ridgway, the headline, Justice Probe of Spy Leak Could Shield Bush. The president now has an excuse not to talk about Spygate here because he's initiated an investigation into who leaked the information to Risen. Now, think about this. If Richard Nixon had come out and said, Watergate, yes, it's perfectly legal, bugging the Democratic National Headquarters, or whatever else I did, it's all perfectly legal, and by the way, we're going to find out who leaked this information to that Woodward and Bernstein, and we're going to nail his butt to the wall. We're going to go out and get him. Can you imagine? I mean, that was back when America realized that the Fourth Estate really has a job to do, that there really is a reason for the Fourth Estate. James Risen's book apparently opens with a story about an Iraqi-American anesthetologist? I don't know how to pronounce anesthesiologist, thank you very much. An anesthesiologist in 2002. Obtaining information from her brother, who worked for Saddam Hussein. Dr. Sao San al-Haddad of Cleveland, on behalf of the CIA, in 2002, gets on a plane and goes to Iraq. This is, before the war, goes to Saddam Hussein's Iraq and talks with her brother. And says, tell me about the nuclear program. You were working on this nuclear program. Tell me about it. And he says, there is no nuclear program. We shut that thing down a decade ago. It doesn't exist. It's not going on any longer. Ain't here. Sorry. And, and this is her brother. She's like, this is a credible source. So she goes back and she says to the CIA, there's no program. No program. In fact, in all, the book says some 30 family members of Iraqis made trips to their native country, that being Iraq, to contact Iraqi weapons scientists, and all of them, 100% of them, the CIA went out and recruited 30 people, 30 Iraqis living in the United States who had relatives in Iraq who were involved in Saddam's weapons programs, and all 30 of those people made trips to Iraq and talked to their relatives, and they all came back, and all of them reported, this is from the Associated Press, and all of them reported that the programs had been abandoned. And yet, in October 2002, a month after the doctor's trip to Baghdad, the U.S. Intelligence Community issued a national intelligence estimate that concluded Iraq was reconstituting its nuclear program. How could it be? How could it be that the CIA is getting all of these folks who are related to Iraqis who are involved in Saddam's weapons program, sending them over, they check it out, they come back, they say there's nothing there. Hans Blix goes over, he travels all around the country, he says, there's nothing there. You get Don Rumsfeld, goes, oh, no, no, we know where they are, they're in that Sunni triangle, that's where they are, they're north and west of Baghdad. And Blix says, great, show us where they are. Actually, it's Mohammed al-Baradei, who is the head of the nuclear investigation program, the IAEA, says, show me where they are. And Rumsfeld says, well, I can't do that. That's secret. And Blix, Hans Blix, he comes out and he says, takes more than just rumors. We want evidence. And he was traveling all over the country, and he was unimpeded. Saddam Hussein at this point was scared. And he would say, fine, you can go anywhere you want. And Blix is like, you know, Bush's faith in weapons of mass destruction is like the Inquisition's belief in witches.
You know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
Yeah, but Bush, while he's saying, I don't think I want to go to war, and I'm in charge here.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah. But then, you know, the bottom line is that we don't, you know, the smoking bomb, you recall? The smoking bomb. So anyway, here now Risen's book comes out, and Bush, the CIA sent these guys over, and they came back and they said, there's nothing there. Blix says there's nothing there. The members of the Security Council refused to vote for the power for the United States to attack Iraq before the fact. And, you know, just by virtue of our bully ability, we were able to, after the fact, go in and say, you know, give us retroactive authority. Tell, you know, say that it was okay. Because Resolution 1440 explicitly said that there could not be any hostile action against Iraq until Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei certified that there were, in fact, weapons of mass destruction, or a high probability that they were and they were being covered up. And the opposite is what was happening. And so Bush had to rush into this thing. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Heard anything about a movie that Hollywood's coming out with called Armageddon George?
Armageddon George. Oh, no.
And it's starring the Profits for Profits in the oil and military complex?
No.
Hey, you know something about George, Tom?
What's that, Armin?
You know, when you go to Kmart or Walmart or wherever you go, you get gas, you always get a receipt. This guy doesn't want to give the American people a receipt anymore.
Yeah, whether it's for a war or for a vote.
Right.
Yeah.
And
I've
one other
that.
Thing about education. Mm-hmm. This is a sad state in this country. Look at the money we spend for education, and I'll tell you what I'll bet you. I'll bet you there's more adult males in this country that know the statistics about the playoffs of football than they know that 50% of the people in this country are illiterate.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's 50%, but yeah.
It's close to it, 50 to 60, I'll bet you.
Yeah, depending on how you define it. Okay, well, good point, Armin, and thank you very much for calling and sharing with us. It's always good to hear from you. This whole thing with, you know, Bush coming out and saying, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to get... At times you just want to say, you know, why me, George?
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown?
Why me?
Tell me, George, what did I ever do for a whiz kid like you to bring chaos to my home?
Indeed.
Lord, help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own gain. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here. Tell me, George, if there's any damn way...
And on it goes. And on it goes. That's Jim Turr from Blue Canyon Productions, BlueCanyonSatire.com. You know, with a great, you know, why me, George? You can find the clip over there. But it's just, is this particular chicken going to come home to roost? I've got a list here of Republican quotes about the impeachment of Bill Clinton that I was going to share with you. But I'm just, it's almost hyperbolic. It's just, it's becoming so obvious we have a problem here. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you.
And welcome back to the program, my friends. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman radio program. Jack Abramoff rolling over, and I gotta tell you, this is amazing. Let's just take a quick look here, and we can extend this into the next hour of the program because it's still just a quick look at some of the politicians who are probably going to get swept up into this Abramoff scandal. For example, there's one guy that Abramoff took a $9 million fee from a foreign power in order to arrange a meeting with one guy. $9 million Abramoff makes by saying, I can get you a meeting with this guy. And he does it. That guy, President George W. Bush. In fact, Abramoff was a contributor. Maximum allowable amount to Bush's 2000 recount fund, to his 2000 campaign. In mid-2003, to his re-election campaign, he had raised at least $100,000 for it. He was one of Bush's pioneers. He also shuttled $36,000 from the Tan family, these clothing factories in the Saipan Islands, to George W. Bush, or at least to his campaign. So, number one person implicated in the Abramoff scandal, George W. Bush, President of the United States. Number two, David Safavian, the former head of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. I believe he's the only guy so far who's actually been indicted. He's, or at least investigating. Yeah, he's been arrested. He was arrested for lying and obstructing the Abramoff investigation. Who does David Safavian work for? George W. Bush. In fact, he was the top federal procurement official under Bush. He resigned back in September and was arrested, accused of lying and obstructing a criminal investigation into Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff's dealings with the federal government. The complaint filed by the FBI alleges the Safavian 38, a White House procurement official who involved until last week in Hurricane Katrina relief efforts, made repeated false statements to government officials about a golf trip with Abramoff to Scotland in 2002. Now, that happens to be the same golf trip that involved $240,416 in 2001 and Abramoff and Robert Ney, the Republican from Ohio, and Ralph Reed, former Christian Coalition leader, to St. Andrews, Scotland, with a stopover on London on the way back. So number two, David Safavian. Number three, Susan Ralston. Her job, special assistant to George W. Bush and assistant to Karl Rove. Abramoff connected Ralston and Rove. His presidential advisor, this is from the National Journal, his presidential advisor Karl Rove set up shop at the West Wing in 2001. He was looking for an assistant to serve as a trusted gatekeeper of his new fiefdom. Super lobbyist and Republican fundraiser Jack Abramoff was happy to lend a hand. Abramoff knew just the right person for the job, his own assistant, Susan Ralston. She interviewed with Rove and got the position. Mm-hmm. Number four. Gail Norton, Secretary of the Interior. Norton's group received over $50,000 from Abramoff's clients. Who did Gail Norton work for? Well, she worked for George W. Bush. She was in his cabinet, as secretary level in his cabinet. She got $50,000 from one Indian tribe, $10,000 from the DeLay Foundation, and on it went. Number five. What are we up to? Five, six here? J. Stephen Griles. Who did he work for? Well, he worked for Gail Norton, who worked for George Bush. He was the deputy secretary of the Interior Department. J. Stephen Griles testified that Mr. Abramoff had offered him a position at Greenberg Tartig while Mr. Griles was in a position to affect decisions involving Mr. Abramoff's Indian clients. So, okay, we've got, there's your administration connection, starting with George W. Bush. Ralph Reed, I mean, Reed's connections to this guy just go on and on and on. Reed paid $4.2 million to help Abramoff clients. Reed was paid $4.2 million between 2001 and 2003 to mobilize Christians to oppose the plans of those threatening Abramoff's Indian gaming clients, the Choctaws. Yeah, right. He went on that infamous trip to Scotland. He was involved in this whole Tagua casino scandal. Okay, Ralph Reed. Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. These are the people that might get dragged into this thing. Cronyism. Norquist sees nothing unethical in Abramoff's dealings. Yeah. Well, those are, you know, and then we get into elected officials. Representative Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi. Senator David Vitter, Republican of Louisiana. Representative Pete Sessions, Republican of Tennessee. Senator Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada. Bob Ney, Republican of Ohio. Trent Lott, Republican of Mississippi. Ernest Istook, Republican of Oklahoma. J.D. Hayworth, Republican of Louisiana. Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa. Denny Hastert, Republican of Illinois. Charles Grassley, Republican of Ohio. Tom Feeney, Republican from Florida. And Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota. These are all folks connected to Jack Abramoff. All folks who may, Jack Abramoff may end up rolling over on all these folks. Looks like he's pleading guilty. He's going to start singing like a canary, and there's a whole bunch of folks quaking in their boots. From John Doolittle in California to George W. Bush, right now, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here for the third hour of our program. I don't know if it flew right by you or something that you'd want to be sure not to miss, but Ahmed Chalabi, remember that guy? The guy who was being paid $300,000 a month by the Pentagon to provide us with intelligence about Iraq? At the same time that the CIA was sending over, according to James Risen's new book, sent over 30 relatives of people working on Saddam's weapons program, and all 30 of them came back and said, there is no weapons program, sorry. Ahmed Chalabi, who hadn't been in Iraq for decades, he had been living in exile in England ever since he had been convicted in absentia of bank embezzlement in Jordan, bank fraud, and sentenced to 23 years of hard labor. A sentence, by the way, which still is in force. Ahmed Chalabi came to the United States and said, oh, no, no, we'll create the Iraqi National Congress and we'll give you this information and all you've got to do is just, you know, let me be the richest man in Iraq once more. Actually, Ahmed Chalabi himself wasn't the richest man in Iraq. His father was before Saddam ran him out of the country in the 1960s. So here now we have Chalabi, who in the election apparently did not even get 1% of the vote, did not even receive, now, again, the final vote isn't in, and Wally O'Dell hasn't finished his trip over there and to double-check the vote. I say that facetiously for those of you who are going, what? What? No, 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 just kidding. But the final count hasn't come in, and we haven't had an opportunity to finally fix it or whatever. But it looks like Chalabi didn't even get enough votes to become a member of parliament. So he was made the oil minister. That's right, the oil minister. Ahmed Chalabi, now the guy who is in charge of all the oil in Iraq. And you know, there's a lot of oil in Iraq.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And for those of you who don't know who Wally O'Dell is, he's the former president of Diebold, remember, who said, I am committed to bringing to victory for George Bush in Ohio, or something, claiming Ohio, whatever the phrase was. Anyhow, the refinery just reopened there. The decision, you know, Ibrahim Bar al-Awlam says he quit, the former oil minister, he quit because the government raised fuel prices 9 times on December 19th, a decision he strongly criticized. But, you know, hey, they got to make some money. I mean, we got a war to pay for, right? So Chalabi is now in charge. Here we got this guy. He's such a crook. And so we put him in charge of the oil. Well, gee, what a surprise. Charisse in Paulsboro, Washington. Hey, Charisse, thanks for calling the Tom Hartman program. What's up?
Hi. Hi, I just had a quick question for you. I was wondering, with all of the pre-warnings for 9/11 and all the horrible things that have been done by this administration, I'm not going to list them, you know it there, why isn't depraved indifference the phrase of the day?
Because I suspect because it's too much of a value judgment. It is probably, I would agree with you that it is accurate. But actually, I don't think it was indifference. I suspect that it was intentional. I can't imagine that these guys, that George W. Bush got 56 separate warnings that Bin Laden was going to be, you know, that they were going to be hijacking aircraft, that they were looking at high-profile targets, that he was determined to strike inside the United States, and just simply ignored them. I don't believe it.
Well, then how about Katrina?
Katrina, that's a
good
question.
There's so many places that depraved indifference seems to be the
I would apply that to I would apply that to Katrina. Although, you know, there are conspiracy theories around Katrina as well. You know, without New Orleans or without most of the poorer population of New Orleans, suddenly Louisiana becomes a red state, and
right.
The governor won't get reelected, and their Democratic, I believe they have one Democratic senator, won't get reelected, and boom, you've got now another red state. Isn't
right.
that great?
Right.
So, I'm not a subscriber to that particular conspiracy theory. I think that it was just massive incompetence on the part of FEMA. Although, when you look at their response to Hurricane Charlie a year earlier, before the election in 2004, when that hurricane hit Florida, mm-hmm. FEMA was there.
Right.
They were there. Man, they were passing out checks to people who didn't even live in Florida.
Right, I read
could
that
vote
stuff.
In Florida.
But, I mean, especially with regard to FEMA, depraved indifference, where what's his brownie sitting having dinner at the Olive Garden and not caring that his people are saying, my God, we're dying down here.
Yeah, yeah. It's a tragedy. Charisse, you raise a good question, and I thank you for calling and raising it. Michael in Austin, Texas. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, not too bad. God, I'm glad she brought up Katrina. My basic principle is, with Air America, I've got a major problem. I talked to Randy Rhodes a while back, a couple weeks. I talked to her about Katrina. Let me ask you the same question I asked her, because I'm curious on your opinion. You seem like a more balanced kind of guy. FEMA screwed up, no doubt. Now, she yelled and screamed at me and cut me off. And, you know, if you feel the need to do that, okay, but this is your program, and I can respect that. My question is, why, from the beginning, didn't they judge the people from the mayor on up? And I'm going to start with the school buses. And this is what I asked Randy. You know, why in the world didn't they utilize those buses if they couldn't utilize them, at least get them to higher ground so they could?
Yeah, that was a very compelling photograph on the cover of Drudge for an entire week, for 7 days.
Right.
Drudge ran that picture, and millions
that.
And millions of people saw it. I'm assuming that you saw the testimony of the governor where she was asked that question.
Well, I saw that. I read other news reports, and I thought, well, at least if, you know, if they can't use those buses then.
Well, did you recall what the governor said?
Refresh my memory, Tom.
Okay. Michael, the governor, Governor Blanco, was asked, why did you or the mayor not use the buses, or why did you not order the mayor to use the buses, or why did the mayor not use the buses? And she said, and this was in testimony under oath before Congress, she said that they contacted FEMA and said that they were going to use the buses. And FEMA specifically told them to leave the buses where they were and to not use them because they were bringing in, now here's where my memory may go bad, it was either 698 or 968, some certain number of hundreds of air-conditioned buses that FEMA had access to that they said that they would have there. And so they left those buses there on FEMA's orders.
Well,
that little part of the story somehow never made it onto the Drudge report. But I saw it in her testimony. It's right out there. Anybody can read it.
I believe you, Tom. If that's the case, shame on both of them, because I would have taken the initiative to go ahead and take care of that.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Michael.
My main thing here, the reason I called, I've been listening to Air America more at night because I'm driving home late. And I don't want to listen to the spacecraft guys. I hear everyone complaining, you know, the Bush crime family, you know, cronyism, all this. Why is it that, you know, your side, and I'm going to call that, the right side, isn't expounding any ideas towards, okay, this is what we ought to do?
Well, I don't think if first of all, I'm not only unwilling to, but frankly not capable of defending or speaking for any other programs on any other stations or any other network. But I can tell you
about this program and what
I talk about on this program on a regular basis are the things that we should do. I suggest, for example, that if we want to solve our trade problem, that we should walk away from these multilateral trade treaties that only profit multinationals and go back to the tariff system that built this nation and made it great. I suggest that we should have a decent minimum wage in this country. If we want to make industry in this country competitive with all the other countries in the world, here you had Toyota. They were offered over $400 million by Alabama or Louisiana, I forget which one, to build an auto factory down there, and they ultimately decided to build it in Canada with no incentives from the Canadian government because it costs more for health care than for steel to build a car in the United States.
Well, that's
so crazy.
Tom, let me ask you one more question.
I mean, I'll give you a long list of very practical, very positive suggestions that I have for this country.
Well, I haven't listened to your program as much, but let me ask you one last thing, and this is the thing on tax cuts. I didn't tell your screen of this. Whenever the federal government lowers tax rates, do you know what happens to the revenue to the Treasury?
Well, as a matter of fact, I just happen to have the CBO figures right in front of me. Yeah, whenever the federal government lowers tax rates, the revenue goes down.
No, the revenue goes up.
No,
are you getting that info?
It goes from the Congressional Budget Office.
No, no. When tax rates go down, revenues to the Treasury go up. That's a big myth.
Well, let's see here. I would suspect that you've been listening to too many ex-Reaganites here. Let's look at a few years and let's look at the revenue. Okay.
I love Ronald Reagan.
In 1980, Reagan. We're up against a break here. I'll tell you what. When I come back from this break, Michael, I will share the information with you.
That sounds great.
Okay. Good talking to you. Thanks a lot. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
W, you gotta help me. These mercury emission standards are gonna kill my bottom line. You'll take care of it? How much should I make this out for? Do say hello to your pappy.
Yes, it's the billionaires for Bush, led by Jack Abramoff. More to come on that story as it spins out. January 1st, 2006, posting on the Daily Kos, actually, referencing a December 1st, 2005 Congressional Budget Office study. This is the actual study. It came out on the 1st of December of last year, about a month ago. In fact, almost exactly a month ago. The title of it is Analyzing the Economic and Budgetary Effects of a 10% Cut in Income Taxes. That's the title of the piece. They note, and I'm quoting, the paper first uses an estimate provided by the Joint Committee on Taxation that states the government will lose $466 billion in revenue over the first 5 years and $775 billion over the second 5 years. And then you look at the tables, and here's the tables right here, the historical budget data. Now, for example, Reagan cut taxes in 82. And in 82, the revenue was $617 billion. In 83, the next year after the tax cut, federal revenue went down to $600 billion. However, Reagan increased expenses. We spent $745 billion in 1982. In 1983, as revenue went down by $17 billion, his expenses went up by over $50 billion. And so we went from being in 1979, when Carter left office at a negative 39.6% of being on budget, to Reagan, his first year, 82, his first, 81, his first year, 73% negative off budget. Then he cut taxes that year, 82, 120% off budget, 120.6%. This is from the CBO figures, www.cbo.gov. 83, we're down to minus 207.7% of budget. In other words, we've thrown the budget not only into the negative range, but hugely into the negative range. So in 83, he raises taxes. What most folks won't tell you, they'll say, Reagan cut taxes, and by 4 or 5 years later, government revenues were coming back up again. Well, Reagan cut taxes the first 2 years of his presidency, and then he raised taxes every year for the next six. And you see then in 85, 86, 87, you see revenue going up slowly, but expenses are going up more rapidly. And so Reagan's budget deficits were 185% negative, 221% negative, 237% negative in 86, 168% negative in 87, 192% negative in 1988, 205% negative in 1989, 1990, 207% negative. It got all the way up to 300% negative in 93. This is when George Bush was doing things, George W. Bush. And the last year that transited out of that. And then we come in with Clinton, and Clinton starts reversing it. 94, as Clinton raises taxes, now we see revenue going up. It went from $1.2 trillion to $1.3 trillion in 95, to $1.45 trillion in 96, to $1.579 trillion in 97, to $1.721 in 98. And here's how the budget went, the negative figures in the budget went down from 94 to 99. From the negative 258% that he inherited from George W. Bush to a -226%, to a -174% in 96, to a -103% in 97, to -30% in 98, to 1.9% positive in 99, to 86.3% positive in 2000. Then George W. Bush comes into office, and in 2001, now the total government revenues in the year 2000, Clinton's last year, $2 trillion, $25 billion. George W. Bush cuts taxes. Revenues go down. Surprise, surprise. Goes down to $1.991 trillion. He cuts taxes again in 2001. They go down even further in 2002 to $1.853 trillion. Now we've gone from Clinton's 86.3% surplus to a 32.5% minus in 2001 to a 317.5% minus in 2002. And in 2003, we go from $1.8 trillion down to $1.7 trillion in revenue, and expenses up to 2.159, so we're at -538%. It's never been so bad. In 2004, government revenues crept up slightly. You could argue to some extent that that's just the result of a rebound and some inflation, but it had nothing to do with it. And then these guys, they quote Kennedy. They say, oh, this is, you know, Kennedy was the guy. When Kennedy came into office, taxes, marginal tax rates were at, when John Kennedy came into office, marginal tax rates were at 90%. What built the middle class in America was Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s placing the top tax at 90%. Now, if you were a middle class wage earner, you weren't paying anything close to 90%. You were paying 15, 20, 25, 30, 35%, something like that, depending on how much you were making. But if you started making over, in today's dollars, about $5 million, you were paying 90%. And that stood from the 1930s until the 1960s. And Jack Kennedy came along and he said, you know, there's a problem with this 90% cap. But the problem wasn't that it was a 90% cap. The problem, Kennedy said, was that nobody was paying it. I'll share a clip with you from Kennedy and show you how the cons have been lying to you about what Kennedy said and what Kennedy did, and why Kennedy's reduction from 90% down to 70% increased revenue because he actually was raising taxes. Right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Acid rain has got a problem, said the businessman. But all the fish are belly up and floating round. And there's nothing growing from the ground. Just ask Farmer Brown. On the corner are some activists with picket signs. They want the factories to stop their filthy ways. But the government says it's okay, it'll go away any day. Acid rain is up my nose and in my eyes.
Yes, acid rain. Welcome back, my friends. Exposing the con and conservative. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. That's me. Just wanted to wrap this up. I've read you a bunch of numbers there, and for those of you who are not number freaks, my apologies. But the bottom line is, you can look right on, you know, right on the federal websites at the Congressional Budget Office, or for that matter, any website that, you know, organizes government revenues. And when Reagan cut taxes, government revenues went down. What a surprise. Bush cut taxes, government revenues went down. What a surprise. Now, here's the anomaly. What the cons say, and this is the justification that Reagan used, and it's also the justification that Bush used, was that by cutting taxes, they would actually raise revenue, because when Kennedy dropped the top rate from 90% down to 70%, that it raised revenues. The fact of the matter is, though, that what Kennedy said was that he came from a family of people who paid the 90% tax rate, and none of them paid 90%, because there were all these loopholes. The biggest loophole was the dividend loophole, which is, by the way, the loophole that George W. Bush just put back into the tax code. If you make your living right now by sitting on your butt around the swimming pool waiting for your dividend check to arrive, you pay a maximum income tax rate of 15%. And that dividend loophole, Kennedy said, that shouldn't be. People who earn their living by waiting for the check to arrive, like people in the Kennedy family at that time, some of them, he said, should pay the same taxes as everybody else. And so he said, we'll drop the maximum rate from 90% down to 70%, because nobody's paying 90% anyway. And we'll close all these loopholes, and this is actually going to increase revenue. Jack Kennedy was pushing for a tax increase. Nixon was out there saying, look out, Kennedy is going to cut taxes, and that's going to destroy the American economy. That's what Nixon was saying. He was saying Kennedy wants to cut taxes, and it's going to throw the budget out of balance, and he's going to deficit spend, and it's going to ruin the country. And here is Jack Kennedy's response to that.
Yes, I have stated in both debates and state again that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we had in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
So, number one, he says he's in favor of a balanced budget. Compare that to George W. Bush, who took us from a balanced budget that Bill Clinton had to a $500 billion deficit. Next, he says, no, I'm not raising taxes. This 90% top marginal rate down to 70% is actually going to increase revenue because it's accompanied by closing loopholes, particularly the dividend loophole.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion. Through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
There you go. Number one, dividend withholding, and number two, nail the businesses on expense accounts. And then finally, he says, I am so tired of the Republicans lying about what I'm going to do. And he just comes right out and says,
so in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education, we'd spend more money on housing, we'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And there you go, Jack. It is now on the public record. And tragically, you still have conservative commentators out there using Nixon's old lies from the 1960 election campaign to justify these insane tax cuts that just don't work. They don't work. It's like saying, gee, I think I'll take a 20% cut in my income. I'll go to my employer and say, write my check for 20% less. After all, it'll mean I'll have more money. What? Go figure. I mean, you know, George Bush says it and people actually believe it. He says, you know, let's take $500,000 and give it to some rich person, and they'll create one job. And won't that be a wonderful thing?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
1 million divided into $550 billion, that's $550,000 per job. Nope, it didn't work, and it's not working. So, I hope I have answered your question. I've forgotten the name of the caller. Nancy Anton is with us. She's with NewsHounds.us. NewsHounds, they watch Fox, so we don't have to. Thank goodness for you, Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, what are the main memes that Fox is tossing out now?
They're getting very aggressive about attacking people.
Okay.
They're doing the culture war thing as a replacement for the war on Christmas. But one of my blog mates, Chris, caught O'Reilly doing direct threats to the New York Times.
Direct threats?
To tell Bill Keller, who is the executive editor,
right,
and Frank Rich, one of the columnists, and basically saying we're going to put your life under a microscope if you continue to attack President Bush.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, they should expect that in any case, but
I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit further going than they've gone in the past, you know, the direct naming names and saying what you're going to do kind of thing.
Yeah, so O'Reilly is traveling into the sleazy threat territory and you know, if They, in fact, here isn't this quoted? They've led life. They've led lives. If they want to attack people personally, then we're just going to have to show everybody about their lives.
Right.
You think he might be stinging a little after the loofah sponges and stuff? You know, all that.
Isn't it amazing how all of that just sort of rolled off of him?
Yeah, yeah.
As far as the general public is concerned, you know.
Keith Olbermann does a good job of keeping it alive, but
yes,
which is making O'Reilly crazy, I assume.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I noticed that it's actually starting to make it into the mainstream that they're using the word eavesdropping instead of spying these days. Is that happening? Did that originate in Fox?
Yes. Well, that's where we first spotted it.
Tell me about it.
I think that the word eavesdropping is much more benign than the word spying.
Oh, sure. Eavesdropping is what you do.
Most people identify with eavesdropping. You know, you eavesdrop on your friend's telephone call or something, you know.
Yeah, the person sitting next to you in the restaurant.
Right. But spying has many more sinister connotations, and so using the word eavesdropping is sort of minimizing it and saying, ah, not such a big deal, you know. And they're still doing it. They're harping on it. But now they've taken yet another tack and decided that the leak investigation is more important than the actual spying.
Yeah, we've got to find out who this whistleblower is. Who pointed out to us.
No, they're not calling it a whistleblower. That word is not, no.
Okay.
No. This was not someone reporting a crime.
I see.
This was a leaker.
A leaker, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got to find this leaker.
Yeah, exactly.
Find out who this person is.
It's national security. It's the old roll out the national security excuse.
Yeah, and we've got to slam this guy in jail or these people or whoever it may be.
That's right.
Amazing. Now, I understand that that Fox News, is continuing to go on the attack with the ACLU.
That's been one of their targets for a long time, and they are pounding it lately. One good example was on Special Report, where Jim Angle, who was in for Brit Hume, dragged up a lawsuit that was 3 years old and tried to pretend that it was new. It's like, how desperate are you for stuff to attack the ACLU about?
Yeah, I noticed there, in fact, I had a con on this program who, in the whole war on Christmas thing, you know?
Right.
And he was, oh, yes, there's a war on Christmas. The ACLU is leading it. And I'm like, did you know that the ACLU actually argued in favor of a community that had a Christmas crash, you know,
a
nativity
like
scene?
That. No,
they actually
never
argued in favor of it. You know, I mean, they've argued against it in other circumstances, but I mean, they kind of cut it down the middle. I mean, they're.
That's the thing about the ACLU is that they're bound to aggravate everybody some of the time because they really do have principles.
Right, yeah. They've defended
and
Nazis.
Principles
and they
don't
and
always
they
agree with everyone's ideology.
Right. It's like, you know, in Skokie, Illinois.
They defended the Nazis marching.
That's right. And they said, hey, Nazis have rights of free speech, too. And everybody was, oh, my God, you know. So the ACLU is everybody's favorite whipping boy, which is why it's important for, I think, all of us to support the ACLU if we have any hope for the First Amendment. And finally,
and part of the culture war, too.
And finally, the culture war in general.
Right. They had a whole series on Special Report.
You still there, Nancy? Nope. We lost Nancy. So this is Bill O'Reilly must have been listening. I'll tell you, Bill O'Reilly was listening in, and he heard Nancy say that, and he just did.
Well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years.
It just went nuts. It's got to be it. Got to be it.
No, shut up. Now you had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
But it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
Yeah, there you go. The ACLU commenting on Bill O'Reilly. Well, thus we can see why the culture wars and why the ongoing attacks. And thanks to Nancy Anton from newshounds.us. They watch Fox, so we don't have to, even if Fox got her. Hopefully she's okay. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's closing time.
Sick and sad, at least with acid and no less spirits crying. Where's the beef?
Welcome back.
The moon is swimming naked and the summer night is fragrant with a mighty expectation of relief.
Good old Leonard Cohen. Welcome back. I can listen to Leonard Cohen for hours. In fact, I often do. Welcome back to the program. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, 440-8466. Ron in Sacramento, California. Hey, Ron. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening on Talk City, KSAC.
Yes, I know. I've noticed, like everybody, that the buck never ever stops with that weasel Bush. Never takes responsibility. Now he's about to start on another series of mumbo jumbo speeches. You could call whistling through the graveyard about the Iraq fiasco. And one other thing, Mike there sounded like a seminar caller. I think Mike has been listening to government radio too much. Hannity, Limbaugh, Gallagher, Medved, the rest of these people are essentially embedded, bought and paid for radio hoes that get daily or weekly programming directly from Rove or whatever. You could, you know, they're,
yeah, I am actually on some of the email lists, Ron, and every now and then we do a behind enemy lines segment here where I'll tell folks in advance what they're going to be hearing on right wing talk radio that day.
Yeah.
It's not always the same, but when there's something important going on, they certainly are very, very organized because I'm on their lists.
How about Mike? You know, you take Mike Wiener Savage. He's one of the most venal advocates of bombing
Ron, I gotta stop you there. I really don't want to get into talking about other talk show hosts on this program. But your point that Bush doesn't take responsibility for things is well taken, and I agree with you. And I think his strategy of pretending to take responsibility, his recent one, where he says yes, we did have bad intelligence, was actually a way of avoiding even greater responsibility, and that was the responsibility of lying and manipulating intelligence. And it was a part of a giant obfuscation campaign. Steve in Lake Forest, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Great. What's up?
Quick question for you. I recently wanted to something just kind of stuck out in my head here from something I heard George Bush say lately, and I thought I'd run it by you and see what you think.
Okay.
You know, lately he said, with regard to all the, what I believe, of course, is illegal surveillance, I'm sure I've heard the president, and someone just presented this to me in an argument the other day, that, you know, George Bush took an oath to defend the people of the United States. And
yes,
I
he said
heard,
that. And let me read to you Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 8 of the Constitution of the United States. And I will read you the entire thing, beginning to end. It's all one sentence. Before he enter on the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. This is talking about the executive branch, the president. Following oath or affirmation, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Period.
Exactly.
End of quote. End of Section 1, Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States.
Thank you. That's exactly what I had said in return. That's what I thought, and I've seen it. You know, I mean, how can people forget such
just
an
just tell
event
people, read the Constitution. Yeah, just read the Constitution. And Bush comes out and he says, I took an oath to protect the people. Sorry, you didn't. You took an oath to protect the Constitution. And you can't shred the Constitution while you're trying to protect the people. You can't.
Help me here, Tom. Isn't in the original framers' view, wouldn't it have, and I'm not sure of this, but wouldn't it have been their view that the people were to essentially form a militia to protect themselves?
Well, that was the big debate that led to the Second Amendment. Jefferson wanted there to be no. In fact, he had originally 10 amendments, two of which never made it into the Bill of Rights, and so one of the ones in the Bill of Rights became the sixth, seventh, and eighth. Excuse me, it became three because they all liked 10 because they were all Masons and it was a magic number. But anyhow, Jefferson had two additional ones. One was a ban on corporate monopolies. Corporations could only do one thing, and they could not own other corporations, and that didn't get through because the word corporation doesn't exist in the Constitution. And the second was that he wanted to have an absolute ban on the United States having an army, a standing army, during times of peace. Instead, he wanted every citizen, every male between the ages of 14 and 47, to have a gun in their home and be deputized in a militia, in a local militia under local control. And then the local militias would be under state control, and then the state, you know, and so there was like levels of chains of command where things could be stopped at every level.
Right.
And
so
that way,
of the militia, of and by the people, is
that's right.
called up to protect themselves.
And this is how it's organized in Switzerland. In Switzerland, if the church bells ring a particular way, every man between 14 and 47, I think in Switzerland it goes up to 50-something, grabs their gun and steps out into the street, and the entire country is the army, or every
right,
male
right.
in the country is the army. And that, many people will suggest, many historians will suggest, is why Hitler never invaded Switzerland. And that was the kind of army, that was what Jefferson wanted to have. And he wrote extensively about how he felt that having a standing army during times of peace would lead to, he didn't use the phrase military-industrial complex, but he certainly described it, he didn't have the words for it, would lead to a military-industrial complex that would corrupt the government itself.
That's sort of abuse of power, uh-huh.
That's right, and that's what he was afraid of. And he also was afraid of the possibility of a military coup, and that's why the framers made sure that the commander-in-chief was not a member of the military, but instead was an elected civilian, that being the president.
Well, thank you, sir. I guess maybe Mr. Bush needs to go back and review the Constitution.
yeah. I suspect he already knows this stuff, Steve. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. But, yeah, I suspect he knows it, and he would just as soon not revisit it. He'd really, really rather not go there at all. Robert in Alton, Illinois, we have just a few seconds left. You can have the last word.
All right.
Robert?
Yeah, I'm here.
You got 5 seconds. What's up?
Yeah, I was called. 5 seconds for what?
You were going to say something. You got a comment?
Yeah, I was going to say something. I'm not for that phone tap.
You're in favor of the phone taps?
I'm not in favor of it.
You're not in favor.
I'm not, because of those reasons that I gave. I think it's just wrong for Americans.
That it's an invasion of privacy.
It is definitely.
There you go. Well said, Robert. I appreciate it. Thank you. You closed the show with the exact right words, because that is what George W. Bush is doing, is invading our privacy. I mean, it's like William Sapphire said, do you really want the government listening to your phone conversation with your doctor? I mean, you know, if you're a terrorist, yeah, we're all in favor of the government listening to that. But if you're not, no. And you can get a judge to figure that out for you. Thanks so much for being with us today, friends. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.